I'm Ayelet Waldman.
I'm Paul Waldman.
This is Boundary Issues.
Welcome to Boundary Issues, the podcast where two siblings solve all the world's problems while blaming each other for their own. You know, usually we start off by having Ayelet and me talk a little bit about what's going on in our lives and maybe trade a few insults and gentle ribbing. We're not going to do that this time because this is a very serious topic that we're going to get into, and we have a lot to talk about with our guest. So Ayelet, why don't you introduce him and we'll get right into it.
I am so honored to be able to introduce to you Issa Amro, who I am proud to call a friend. Issa is the founder of the Hebron-based Youth Against Settlements, which is a nonviolent Palestinian resistance movement. And Issa's truly creative forms of resistance were inspired by the likes of Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and they include things as interesting and as unusual as a while ago, he did something called the Shooting Back Camera Project, where he distributed cameras to Palestinians, especially young people, for the purpose of documenting human rights violations by Israeli soldiers and settlers. He's appeared before the UN. He's met with EU members of parliament, other members of parliament, many other people. And he has made time for us today during a period of tremendous crisis. So, Issa, welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us.
Thank you, Ayelet, and thank you, Paul.
So I want to just launch in. First of all, I think that many of our listeners don't know anything about the city of Hebron. So talk to us a little bit about that city. How large is it? Where is it? Who is the population?
Hebron city is one of the oldest cities in the world. And here, Tel Rumeida was inhabited for 5,500 years continuously. All empires, historical empires, lived here. So we have a lot of archaeology and heritage here in Hebron city. Hebron is around 30 kilometers to the southern part of Jerusalem. Hebron is around 250,000 Palestinian inhabitants living inside the city. We have the Ibrahimi Mosque, which is considered as the fourth mosque in Islam. Hebron is famous of agriculture, grapes, and other kind of agriculture. As well, Hebron marble is the best in the West Bank, and Hebron is considered the biggest city in the West Bank these days. And the Hebronites are famous for being hard workers and, working to make a change.
What I want to talk about right now, what I want to get to is your experience right now in Hebron. But I think it's important to understand that to get a little bit of an idea of what happened in Hebron when the Israeli settlers invaded the city, what they did and what the consequences were and how long that has been going on. So will you tell us a little bit about that invasion?
Yes, Hebron was occupied in 1967. After 3 years of occupying Hebron, they established a settlement called Kiryat Arba. It's outside the city. It's one of the most well-known settlements in the West Bank, and it's one of the first where now Itamar Ben-Gvir lives and many other Kach Kahana movement leaders live. It's called Kiryat Arba. Then 1979, a group of settler women during Passover, we are almost in Passover now, they occupied a building inside the city. So Hebron is the only city in West Bank after Jerusalem where Israeli settlers are living inside the city. So 1979, they occupied one building. Then they occupied other buildings in the area. And we have five settlement compound inside the city. And the presence of the settlers in the beginning was not seen there. They were minority. They were without any real consequences on the people. No closure. The streets are open. The market is open. Till 1994.
Before you go to 1994, I just want to say briefly something about Kiryat Arba, the settlement, and then this outpost. So the thing to understand, if you were to drive through Kiryat Arba, you would say, oh, this is just a town. This is just a beautiful town. It is an illegal settlement. All the settlements are illegal, but this one was an illegal settlement that was turned into basically a bedroom community. And this outpost is illegal upon illegal. You know, they crept in completely without any kind of notice, permission, and they basically took over these buildings a little bit at a time. Okay, so then Isa, continue your story.
So 1994, the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre, where Baruch Goldstein, one of the followers of Ma'ir Kahana, Kach movement, broke into the Ibrahimi Mosque and he murdered 29 Palestinians and 100 were injured. This was the main milestone in the city, where when I was a child, I was not able to go to school for 3 months. They divided the streets, they divided the markets, they divided the mosque, they closed the Shuhada Street, they closed the whole neighborhood. So we were the victims of the Israeli settlers' terror, and we were punished by the Israeli government for being the victims of the Israeli far-right-wing extremists. This is how they were called, you know, on the 1994. Now, Baruch Goldstein followers and supporters and partners are in the Israeli government. They became lawmakers from 1994 to 2024. And after the massacre, it was a big deal for me personally. I was traumatized. I was really, you know, not feeling well to see something like that happen. Then we have Hebron redeployment agreement, peace agreement. And one of the main obstacles for Oslo was Hebron massacre, the Ibrahim Mosque massacre, which was done by the Israeli right wing. So they did two things. They assassinated Rabin, and the other big thing they did was the Ibrahim Mosque massacre. So in 1997, we had Hebron redeployment agreement, peace agreement. They divided the city for H1, Hebron 1, under the Palestinian Authority control, and H2 under the Israeli military control, where I live here now.
Here we have this Palestinian city inhabited by hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. This terrorist goes into a mosque, kills 29 people, injures another 100. He is killed before he can kill any more. His tomb is outside of Hebron by Kiryat Arba, and it has become a monument, a pilgrimage site. If you go to see this tomb of this terrorist, of this vicious terrorist, it is covered with stones, which is what Jews do when we are honoring our dead. It is a place of worship for right wing. And the Kach movement, Meir Kahana's movement, was criminalized in Israel. It was considered a terrorist movement. It is now, as Isa says, members of that movement and even farther right are now in government controlling the Israeli government. So that's the shift that's happened. They divide, in the wake of this massacre, they divide the city. They take control of the city away from its inhabitants, from people who have lived there for, I don't know, thousands of years. And Isa, before we talk about now, do you want to tell a little bit about what Shuhada Street is like, and specifically, and then what it's like to live in your city in H2?
Yes. So 1997 was the Hebron peace agreement. It was part of Oslo agreement. And unfortunately, the Israeli government didn't have enough good intention to make peace and give the Palestinians autonomy and reach the two-state solution. So 1999, they didn't end the H1, H2 agreement and have Hebron part of Palestine. That was the agreement. So the second intifada started. The Israeli settlers gave a demand letter to the Israeli military. The demand letter was to close the streets for Palestinians, to close the markets of the Palestinians, to impose curfew on the Palestinians, to make the Palestinians' life harder and harder. Unfortunately, as always they do, the Israeli military follows the Israeli settlers well. They closed the streets, they closed the markets, they closed the shops. They imposed curfew on Palestinians from 2001 to 2003, 377 days of curfew on the Palestinians who are living. As now we have curfew in Hebron, despite that we did nothing to be punished. This is how they act as Israeli government, because they have the all the power. And one of the main street which was closed first 1994 after the mosque massacre, reopened partially 1997 and reclosed again in 2000, was Shuhada Street. Shuhada Street is our Times Square. You know, this is how you compare it. You know, a street full of people, full of visitors and tourists, and the main bus station, the main shopping area. I was a child. I remember my father used to hold my arm not to lose me because of the number of the crowds, because of the crowds and because of the customers. It was really a live street. After 2000, the street was closed completely. We are talking about 1,800 shops closed because of the closure policy, which is 77% of the shopping area in the city center of Hebron. We're talking about almost 100,000 Palestinian apartments. More than 40% of the apartments became empty because of the closure policy. Around 100 movement barriers, which is really restricting the movement of the Palestinians, not the Israeli settlers, and around 22 checkpoints in less than 1 kilometer square. Something else very important, Ayelet and Paul, they changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic names to an Israeli Hebrew names. So the Shuhada Street, it's King David Street, and the army call it Chicago Street. Where I was born is in El Bab el Khan. It's called Emek Hebron now. There is a sign in Hebrew and in English, Emek Hebron. So they changed the names and they are changing the identity. And despite in the peace agreement 1997, which Netanyahu signed in 1997, it says that the Israeli authorities has to protect the Palestinian identity of these areas. If you come to Hebron by yourself, to the city center of Hebron, you will see blue and white signs only. Israeli flags, Israeli signs, everything. They are moving it to become part of Israel. It's a kind of annexation of the West Bank. In the city center, around Shuhada Street, you find other shopping areas, other streets fenced by fences to protect Palestinian customers who go to that street from the Israeli settlers' trash and stones. If you go and look to Palestinian windows, all the windows are fenced to be protected from the settler violence, especially in the Jewish holidays. And the main one, the famous one, is Shabbat Haysara, and Purim, because they get drunk and they attack the Palestinian houses and the Palestinian people. So the city, from one of the most beautiful cities, one of the most beautiful neighborhoods, and really was really many, many tourists, Jewish tourists, Christian tourists, because the city has really, it's a holy for everybody. It's the city of Abraham, and Abraham is the father of all the Abrahamic religions. So the city moved from one of the most beautiful cities in Palestine to a ghost town, to the town of checkpoints, closure, settler violence, army violence, and restrictions of movement. And nowadays, it's much even harder on the Palestinians who are living in this area.
Walking through this area of Hebron is an uncanny experience. So, like Issa says, I want the listener to imagine Times Square, Fifth Avenue. Paul, what is the beating heart of Washington, D.C., with the most shops, the most sort of
Probably DuPont Circle or K Street
DuPont
or.
Circle. Great. So imagine this area, 100,000 apartments, 1,800 stores, and when Issa says it's closed, what that means is they make it what they call sterile. So everything, they put these, they solder metal locks, essentially, barriers, so that none of the doors on the street can be opened or in this area. These are buildings owned by Palestinian families, some of whom, like I said, have owned them for hundreds upon hundreds of years. And the only way to get into them, if you're even allowed in, is to go through a window in the back. And the street is empty. Who is allowed to walk on the street? Israeli settlers. Foreigners, I can walk on that street, and I have this boulevard that was like Fifth Avenue, full of shops, full of homes, a beautiful street. I can walk on it, and I have walked on it. Issa isn't allowed. So when we talk about what apartheid is in Israel, and everybody gets so upset and they say there's no such thing as apartheid, it is incredibly important for people to understand that the experience of one race of people or nationality of people being banned from their own home, their own street, and another race of people, nationality of people being permitted to walk freely on that street. There is no other word to describe this than apartheid. Okay, so Issa, fast forward, and now I want to bring you to today. So we have this historical context. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the historical context?
Yes, something very important that me, I live here. The settlers, they live just a few meters from here. Just, you know, 5 meters, it's the settlement. I am under the Israeli military law. I am without basic human rights. Even non-violence resistance is not allowed according to the Israeli military law. I was arrested, indicted, convicted, and many other Palestinians were arrested, indicted, and convicted.
How many times have you been arrested, Issa, who is a non-violent protester, who's never committed any kind of violent act in his life? How many times have you been arrested, Issa?
Hundreds of times. They arrest me whenever they want because they can. This is the military system. I don't exist as a human for the military system. Non-violence resistance is not allowed. It's not allowed. Peaceful protesting is not allowed. Free expression is not allowed according to the Israeli military law. And it's between 1 year to 10 years in jail. And I was convicted by the military court and I paid the fine and they have suspended jail time. But I have been in jail many times and ill-treated many times. So the settlers are here and I am here. I am without basic rights as a Palestinian. Not only me, the majority of all my Palestinian neighbors are the same. The house where I was born, which we own until now, here in the area, I'm not allowed to visit. I'm not allowed to enter. I can't see it, but I don't have access to the house, my parents' house. I can't. It's empty now. Something else very important, Ayelet and Paul. Here the policy is they don't evict you physically from your house. They don't come and take you out and throw you, but they make it impossible for you to stay. How it's impossible for you to stay? You don't feel safe. There is no security or no protection for me from any security body here. Something else, no services. So blacksmith, the plumber, ambulance, doctors, they can't come here. It's not allowed. And then no social life. Nobody's coming. Nobody can come here. I'm alone tonight, you know, and I had, it's Ramadan. I just had breakfast alone because the area is closed completely. We can talk about it more later. So this is the situation that one people, they get all the rights, all the political and governmental support to stay with life quality, free education, no taxation, everything is possible. Who are the settlers? They have guns, they have protection, they have everything for them. And we, the Palestinians, were oppressed without basic rights, and they work hard to make us, force us leave the houses here, and it's happening. We have 40% of the houses empty. It's the policy is working. And in the other hand, do you see many visitors? You have many tourists, especially American tourists, to them, and we don't have a voice. We don't have any kind of power to say no or yes to the surveillance system they use against us. Now they are using surveillance with artificial intelligence to profile us, to violate our privacy, to monitor us, to spy on us as Palestinians. Before October 7th, you know, people who are getting in and out, they used to know who's coming to my house, who's leaving, the checkpoints, the same. This is the surveillance system. And the surveillance system they use with this new technology, the Red Wolf and the Blue Wolf, Amnesty International made a huge report about it. You can find it. We don't know what they do with the data. It's a kind of simulation. They treat us as really as human animals. This is what's going on here.
I'm going to describe a little bit of the harassment that I saw on just random occasions when I visited you and I visited Hebron. And then I want you to talk about the campaign of harassment from the settlers and then also from the soldiers. So I saw a group of settlers throw rocks, not stones, rocks at a group of little girls on their way to elementary school and kindergarten. I saw that. I saw adult people, men and women, throwing rocks at little girls as they were walking to school with my own eyes. I saw Issa's power lines cut by settlers who live above his house. I saw garbage and worse thrown during in the other parts of the city. They have settlers' homes right over the market streets, so they have installed these kind of metal grills, sort of nets almost over the market streets. Why? Because the settlers throw garbage and feces and crap down on those below them. I saw that with my own eyes. I saw when Issa and I were walking many, many checkpoints for fun as a game. I saw soldiers trap him inside like one of those rotating entryways just to humiliate him in front of us. So these are things that I saw with my own eyes. I saw soldiers invade him when we were having a meal. We were just having hummus and pita in his garden, and we were invaded randomly for no reason by a group of soldiers. So that's the stuff I saw with my own eyes on a lovely afternoon. So Issa, tell us about the campaign of harassment and violence being carried out by the settlers, and then we can talk about the soldiers as well.
The settlers, they are under the Israeli civil law, and we are under the military law. So they have power on us. Here I was attacked many times physically by many, many settlers. My house was burnt by settlers more than one time. They threw a lot of rocks and stones and rubbish and on the house. They stole my grapes on Shabbat, and I was stealing the rabbi who stole my grapes. Shabbos, what are you doing? Shabbat. They don't care. They steal. They stole my construction materials. They stole my water pipes, my water pump. So whenever I leave for a few hours, they come and steal. My camera system here, the surveillance system, the CCTV cameras, were destroyed and stolen by settlers 3-4 times, at least. Recently, my main gate door was damaged by the settlers during Purim. And during Purim, the house was attacked many times. You can take what happened to me and take it as a general behavior of the settlers on Palestinians. Physical attacks on Palestinians, verbal attacks on Palestinians, without any kind of accountability. I remember that one time I filed a complaint about settlers who cut my fence. I have a very ugly fence here to protect myself. It's the only way for protection, unfortunately. And by time, I'm adding more and more fences here. This is what I can do only. They cut the fence. I went to the police station. I filed a complaint. I gave the name of the settler. I gave his address, his father's name. I gave the police video of what happened. 2 weeks later, the police called me and told me, Issa, the case is closed because we don't know who did it. I told the policeman who called me, I gave you the name. I gave you where he lives. I gave you the video. I gave you his father's name. Do you want me to catch him for you as well? He said, no, it's unknown person. This is the political will not to make the settlers accountable for their terror, not violence. They are terrorists. They act with impunity. And it's not only in Hebron, Ayelet, and Bol. It's all over Area C, from Nablus to Ramallah. And you know about Purim, about many other, about Hawara, to Jordan Valley, to around Jerusalem, to around Bethlehem, to around Hebron, especially Masafer Yatta, South Mount Hebron, and inside H2 in Hebron. The settlers are so wild, and they are well protected by the Israeli military, even during their terror. And after their terror, the army and the Israeli police try to cover their crimes. And I want to give you a direct example. Itamar Ben-Gvir, I know him when he was very young. I saw him throwing stones. He attacked me personally, 2007, near Kiryat Arba, when I was working, volunteering in a Palestinian land. He was not allowed to be in the Israeli military because he was so violent, teenagers, you know, teenagers.
Well, let's say that again for our listeners. Itamar Ben-Gvir was banned from the IDF because he was a terrorist. He was violent. And the IDF said, we cannot have that man who is so crazy and so violent in our... He was too violent for the IDF. So keep going, Issa.
But he is now the Israeli national security minister who's giving orders to the police, to the border police, and to many special forces in the Israeli security system.
Okay, so now, Issa, what's going on now? Tell us what has been happening in Hebron to you, to your family, to your friends, to your community since October 7th.
Yes, October 7th was a very bad day for me as well, Ayelet. I almost lost my life. I was coming back to my house late morning. I left in the morning, the house here, early morning, around 7. I heard about the rockets. I didn't care because I thought that it's a normal round of escalation. So I went to work. Then in the middle of the day, I knew that it's not something normal. I decided to go back early to the house. I came back to the house. I saw my settler neighbors here with guns, with military uniform. They blocked my way to the house. They prevented me from reaching my house and they threatened to shoot me and arrest me. So I decided to give up, and usually I don't. I remain till I get my rights. But it was so violent day. I went around. I came from another direction. A soldier saw me, because I'm well known to the soldiers. He told me, Isa, come with me to take you to the house. I reached outside my house, here exactly, a group of soldiers from the normal soldiers, Nahal Brigade, and among them were settlers in an army uniform, my neighbors, other neighbors.
So they're donning uniforms even though they're not soldiers. So they're
no, doing yes.
basically cosplay as soldiers in order to carry out this kind of illegal, false pretense that they're soldiers carrying weapons.
Yes, to have the power of the soldiers. This is what they want. And they detained me, kidnapped me to the military base. They know me. You know, the soldiers know me. The settlers know me. They kidnapped me to the military base. And I was tortured continuously for 10 hours. From midday to midnight, I was tortured by soldiers and settlers. And it was so painful to be tortured and sexually assaulted by the soldiers. I was gagged for the first time in my life, gagged by soldiers, blindfolded in a way that, you know, my head almost exploded. My hands were tied to the point that I was screaming from pain for 10 hours continuously. They tied it to the point the plastic ties went into my skin, then hitting me, kicking me, spitting on me, triggering the gun and put it in my head to shoot me and say it count to 10. I fainted 2 times and they didn't care. I get no food, no water. It was very cold, air conditioning on me. It was a torture. They were rejoicing. They were celebrating, torturing me. Then one of the soldiers, he's the only one. There were around 30, 40 soldiers and settlers. And settlers came to take selfies with me. The soldiers photographed what they did to me. They filmed what they were doing to me. Said, "Yes, lachem ishur," you know, told the other soldiers, "Do you have permission to do this?" The other soldiers said,
"One
yes.
soldier comes to your defense."
Yes, he said, and everybody else, you know, they were rejoicing, happy, and they said, "Yes, yes, we have ishur." So my torture was an order from one of the commanders, and the army denied that I was kidnapped by the army. My Israeli lawyer was calling. The army, calling the police, calling the Red Cross was calling because I was kidnapped. I disappeared. And they said, no, he's not with us. At the midnight, they sent me to the house. They let me go. It was a long story too. And I was kept in the house for 1 week without food. Then after 1 week, I came out one day. And all the soldiers were settlers in an army uniform. They came to the house here. They vandalized everything. They destroyed my signs, my cameras. They attacked the house many, many times. And I was not allowed to leave.
I want to interrupt with just one thing. So, Paul, this is actually, so Nahal unit, you know who is in the Nahal unit? Our brother, Ilan, who is, Isa, a very, to describe him as a peacenik and an anti-Zionist is not, I mean, he's very, very angry and has been for decades about what is happening. And I have to say, I learned a lot from him about the situation. And the Nahal Brigade is where our brother served grudgingly, I would probably add, is the very unit that has been carrying out this kind of violence against Issa. And what's important to know is that Issa is he is someone who is very public. Like I said, appeared before the UN, meets regularly with members of parliament from throughout the world. And this is what they did to him. So you can only imagine what they did to people who don't have access to Israeli lawyers, who don't have people wondering where he is, who actually notice that he's disappeared. I mean, for most people, the only people who might pay attention to their disappearance are their mothers, you know? So this is what's being carried out against Issa. So Paul, do you have a question?
Yeah. Can I ask you, so while this was going on, what kind of things were the soldiers and the settlers saying to you about this?
The soldiers know my politics very well. They listen to me because I meet many groups, and the soldiers, you see them outside listening to what I say. And I'm not Hamas supporter. They know that. I'm not supporting any kind of violence. They know that. I always denounce all types of violence, and I really say all the time, peaceful resolution is the only resolution. The peaceful resistance is the only way to achieve our rights. They know my politics very well. So it's not a suspect of something like that. What they were telling me exactly, each dog has his own day. Each dog has his own day. I'm a dog, and it's my day. They got the attention, that all the attention is in Gaza to revenge from my politics, from me. This is what they were doing. They were saying, you talk about us, you talk about the occupation, you don't want settlements, you want peace. This is what you will get. This is, you know, it's a kind of punishment. It was a kind of revenge for my non-violent politics. And they were telling me openly, you know, your Israeli traitors, the friends, they were referring to the leftists in Israel, the Smolanim. This is what they were telling me, will not help you now. This is what they think. They think it's the time to get rid of their political enemies, even the Israeli leftists. And they started going after Breaking the Silence and Beit Salem and all the Israeli human rights organizations. It's not about Issa. It's about anybody tries to speak loud, openly against the occupation. This is what they were doing to me. And this is what happened to me. And really, you know, to be very honest, I didn't want to talk about it in details. And I didn't mention everything happened to me, Paul and Ayelet. But what made me talk more, especially about the sexual insult I got from the soldiers, I saw that it was a trend. You know, after I was released and I was watching the videos, a lot of videos was released of soldiers torturing Palestinian detainees. People just being grabbed from their homes, handcuffed, blindfolded, then beaten and tortured by Israeli soldiers and by Israeli settlers in an army uniform or by the Israeli police. It's what I told you is what is happening to many, many Palestinians. Palestinians are terrified to death now. And really, to be very honest, when I was with them, I didn't expect I will go back live to my son to be buried. This is what the impression I got, and every time here I live here, I fenced myself. My window is with blocks. I have blocks on the window, blocks, concrete, cement blocks now. I fenced everything here, not only me, the majority of the Palestinians who are living here, they are really terrified to death. Many families left. They don't have now any kind of protection. They don't walk freely. It's a night curfew here. After 9, if the soldier catch you, you will be beaten. You will be detained for many hours. Women, elder, kids, you will be beaten after 9 o'clock. These days, for the community who did nothing, we didn't do anything on October 7th. We live in the West Bank. Then I didn't have food in the house. And didn't allow me to go buy food. So I asked my Israeli friends to bring me food from Jerusalem. They had free access and they were driving all over. They reached outside my house, two groups. One group was sent out with the food, and they didn't let them give me the food, and even the kittens' food, they didn't allow food to the kittens, to my kittens. The second group were beaten, and they took half of the food from them for the soldiers. And the soldiers were my settlers' neighbors. They were in an army uniform, going around, walking around, and acting as wild as possible without any accountability. Then October 20th, I was evicted from my house physically. The soldiers came to the house. They took me from the house physically and they threw me outside. And they said to H1, you are not allowed to live here anymore until the war ends. And then I went to court. I won. I came back. And after I came back, I was attacked again by soldiers. By soldiers. They are settlers, I know. But they are in an army uniform. But they treat them as soldiers. And now We live alone. You don't feel safe. From time to time, the settlers attack you. They throw stones at you. They attack you physically in the street, scare you, closing the checkpoints. Yesterday night, for example, I heard a noise. I saw a big fire, and soldiers were shouting and screaming. I was afraid, and people started calling me. It was around midnight. I saw what's going on. It was a training for the soldiers. We are a training zone for them as well, making fire, shouting and yelling. And I don't see that they are in war. Really, I see that they are enjoying what they do. They acting with supremacy with us, and they treat us at the checkpoints. They dehumanize us. You know, I was really touched by seeing the soldier mistreating 90 years old Palestinian. He's very famous here that his family protected the Jews in 1929. Himself lived with Jews, and they have very good connection with Jews who were living in Hebron before the occupation. They forced him to take off his shoes. He's not able to do it. I helped him to take this off the shoes, to take off his clothes, and he lives in the settlement. The settlement came to him, and his house is called the Cage House. The army called his house the Cage House, and they ill-treat this old man. They ill-treat the kids. They beat up the kids. They threaten the kids. They threaten the women. Now, around 1,000 Palestinian families live in the restricted part of H2 without social life, without visitors, without doctors. So if your daughter is not living with you in the house, she can't come and visit you. Your grandsons, your granddaughters, they can't come and visit you. So no social life at all. You feel alone. You feel that they may come and kill you anytime, the soldiers. And this is what the impression they give you. They went to families, Ayelet, some families, the settlers in an army uniform. They knocked on the door in the midnight. I told them, if you stay here till tomorrow, we'll come to kill you. This is what they told the families. So the families called me, Isa, this is what we got from the army. They don't say settlers. People don't know the difference. They said, this is what we were told from the army. Do you think they will kill us? We have no place to go. We have no relatives outside H2 to live temporarily as other families did. This is the situation in general now.
I think that in America, you know, people have obviously heard a lot about what has happened since October 7th, about the Hamas attacks and the Israeli attack on Gaza. We get a lot of news about how that relates to the American administration and the weapons that we supply to Israel, and the question of how upset Joe Biden is with Bibi
Or not.
Netanyahu or not, and what is America going to do. But this story about what has been going on in the West Bank since October 7th is something that I don't think anybody in America has heard about. I've seen one or two articles about it indicating that there was a real uptick in violence directed by settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank. But is this something, Issa, that is going on across the West Bank? The settlers and their supporters feel like they have now new permission to kind of amp up their harassment, the violence that directed against people in the West Bank.
Yes, these days the Israeli government, led by Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, are implementing their mandate and their policy to annex West Bank to Israel. This is what they are doing. This is the reality on the ground. So they are now funding more and more settlements. The settlement in Hebron, they are adding a new settlement inside the city. They are demolishing more and more houses. The West Bank roads are fragmented. To reach Ramallah, it's five times harder than the normal days, from one city to another, from one village to another. The majority of Palestinians don't work. They don't have income since 6 months. People are starving in the West Bank as well. They don't have enough money to buy food. There is food, but there is no money to buy food. The Palestinian Authority employees, they didn't get regular salary since 6 months because of not transferring the taxation which Israel collect in behalf of the Palestinian Authority to the Palestinian Authority. Army raid to Palestinian villages, Palestinian towns, Palestinian cities. Every night there is an army raid. Soldiers, they raid houses. They beat people. They arrest people. Sometimes they don't arrest. They just search the houses, and before they leave, they draw Stars of David on the houses, on the houses' doors and walls, and the shops in Area A.
Area A is ostensibly, it's supposed to be governed by the Palestinian Authority. They're not supposed to have any authority in Area A.
Yeah, they are misusing the holy of the Stars of David to be a symbol of occupation, a symbol of soldiers attacking Palestinian homes, Palestinian innocent people. So West Bank is not covered Because I tell you what, NBC News contacted me to come to visit me in the house and make a report about Hebron. And we did all the arrangement to come, all the coordination. In the last moment, they called the army spokesperson to inform the army that they are coming to Hebron. The army told them not to come, and they didn't come. So the army spokesperson and the army and the settlers don't want American news outlet and American media to come and explain what's going on the West Bank nowadays.
You know, I don't know if our listeners know this, but there was a mass distribution of weapons from Itamar Ben-Gvir organized this. Weapons paid for by the U.S. government. A mass distribution of weapons to primarily settlers, to what they call security squads, which are just violent groups of settlers. And some of these are people who are so, like Baruch Goldstein before them, are so violent, so aggressive that they have not been permitted to be in the army. They were given weapons with which to, the idea was somehow that though they were not attacked, though they were actually protected, you know, the people who live in the Gaza envelope, so many of them leftists on these kibbutz, they were left to die on their own because so much of the army is deployed in the West Bank to protect the settlers, to allow them to carry out this campaign of terror with impunity. And these are the people who are distributed these weapons, which are now being turned on the Palestinians of the West Bank.
We are talking about 100,000 rifles well distributed. This is what we are talking about. 100,000. This is what Itamar Ben-Gvir was proud of. He said, I distributed 100,000 weapons, you know, piece of weapons to Israelis. And the Israelis who follow him are the settlers, the violent terrorist settlers who attack Palestinians. And really, I see many, and the majority of the settlers are with weapons, especially the violent ones, who are really have record in the Israeli police of their physical violence against Palestinians. So the settlers are becoming a military within the Israeli military. There is no need for a settler to have weapons. They have the military, they have the police, they have everything, especially in the West Bank. The majority of violence in the West Bank is coming out from settlers these days, not from Palestinians. And Palestinians are really afraid. And many innocent Palestinians were killed or arrested. We have around 3,500 Palestinians detained now in administrative detention. It means without trial. They don't know why. The army arrested more than 8,000 Palestinians since October 7th in the West Bank. The army killed more than 400 Palestinians. Many of them, I know, I saw videos of people were executed, elders, kids in the street without showing any threat to the army, without any accountability, without No one is denouncing what's going on. I know a taxi driver who's 67, 68 years old was driving in the morning. He saw the army, stopped the army jeeps. He started going back slowly because he has the experience from before. He was shot in the head, killed. He was escaping. This is an example in everywhere, you know, a lot of videos, B'Tselem.
It's an Israeli human rights organization. So, and go on there.
Yes.
What did they show?
Yes, B'Tselem is an Israeli human rights organization. Breaking the Silence is an Israeli human rights organization. They do their best to highlight the human rights violations in the occupied territories. But unfortunately, the American media is not giving us a space. They don't give us a voice as Palestinians to reach American audience and tell them about our narrative and tell them about the truth. This is something very important.
Issa, what do you think those settlers want? What do they want?
They want Israel from the river to the sea without the Palestinians.
So, you know, it's so interesting because a lot of people latch on to this notion of a two-state solution. I find myself latching on to, even though I know what's going on. And the analogy I heard that was the most clarifying for me is that when you think of a two-state solution, the part that would be the Palestinian state, it's not a contiguous community. It's the best way to think of it is a piece of Swiss cheese where there are these settlements that are the holes growing larger and larger and larger. And the Palestinian community is the tiny bit of cheese that is around it. And that is, there is no way to turn that into an actual functioning state.
And that was the whole point of the settlement strategy from the beginning. I mean, yes, you have these individuals who are there, a lot of whom are American, by the way, who have this idea that from the settlers' point of view, I think a lot of them feel like God has granted this land to them and they're going to go hold it for him. But as a political strategy, the idea was always that the more settlements you create, the more you create that Swiss cheese, the harder it will be to ever have a kind of two-state settlement. And so that the whole strategy was to make two states impossible, to make the occupation infinite forever, that it won't be able to be undone. And each new settlement you build makes it more and more difficult for there ever to be any kind of Palestinian state.
The Israeli settlers, they don't want peace, and they don't think about peace, and they are not pressured to make peace, and they profit from the occupation, and they are well-funded from many countries all over the world, especially from the U.S. The main organization where settlers get funds here in Hebron is Hebron Fund. It's an American 501c3 charity, and they get a lot of money to take our homes, to make our life harder and harder. And they see almost every day American volunteers, they come to work in our land to give it to the settlers and to remove the Palestinian identity of our land here. And they, you know, to talk about one state or two states, it's naive now. It's about making the Israelis accept a peace solution, because they don't want peace. The Israelis, they don't need peace. Israel is too strong to make peace. Why to make peace? They don't need to. They have the American blind support, the European blind support. They get everything they want. And now they are going on to transfer Palestinians from Gaza to Egypt and from West Bank to Jordan. This is what they do. Their ultimate goal. Ask them, what is your ultimate goal? Israel is the land of only Jews, from the river to the sea. This is what they want.
Do you think, Issa, that the goal is that people, Palestinians who live in the West Bank now, that they hope that they'll all be able to sort of shove them into Jordan, and that's where, or is it just you'll just live as you are now in a kind of permanent state of occupation, and you'll give up your hopes to actually have control over your own lives and your own homes?
To be very honest, I explained that there is a policy of they don't evict you directly from your house, but they make it impossible for you to stay. In H2, it's in H1, and it's all over West Bank. The life is not attractive for the Palestinians. Very expensive, no income, no feeling of safety, no future, unemployment. This is happening to everybody in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as well, that you don't build your future here. Go and build it somewhere else. So we have phenomena of brain drains, that we are losing engineers, doctors, and intellectuals who are leaving to go to Europe or to go to other countries to work and live a proper life. So the life in the West Bank is not attractive with the minimum of the needs of a human being. We are talking about the minimum feeling of dignity, the minimum rights. We don't have all of that in the West Bank now. No security, no economy, unemployment, no dreams, no hopes. People are very disappointed. People are very mad. It's really not a good situation. This is what they do. This is what they want us to lose the hope of living equally and with freedom with them. They want us to think only about survival. They want us to be treated as animals who are seeking shelter and food, not as a nation who are seeking freedom, justice, and equality. This is what they work to make the Palestinian people. And to be very honest, after October 7th and the rumors and the treatment of the army and the settlers to Palestinians in the West Bank, I was walking in the streets and people catch me, Issa, you know more. Will they evict us to Jordan? Will they? This question was repeated to me two, three times a day. And until now, people ask, will they evict us? This is what they think, because this is what we know, that their ultimate goal, that Israel is from the river to the sea. They want madly the West Bank without the Palestinians. They want annexation of the land without the people and the inhabitants who are living in this land.
You know, it's interesting. In the United States, we spend a lot of time fighting over the word genocide now. People on the left say it's genocide. People get very angry, even progressives. And I don't engage in that argument. Whether you agree that the wholesale bombing of an entire 2.5 million population as a result of the October 7th attacks is genocide or not, I don't need to engage in that argument with you. But it is very clearly ethnic cleansing, to reduce Gaza to dust, to make it impossible for Palestinians to live. That is ethnic cleansing, to drive people from their home. And we don't need to debate whether it's genocide or not. That's enough. And that is a violation of international law. That is a violation of basic human decency and basic human rights. Isa, you know, our father was, he was one of the founders of Kibbutz Kisufim. And he moved to Israel in the 1940s. He wrote these letters home, and Paul and I did a podcast episode about these. He was very leftist. He was a labor Zionist, you know, leftist Zionist. But the language about the Palestinian population that he writes about, it sounds horribly familiar. Like that idea that they will build a Jewish safety paradise, and that the Arabs, because they don't use the word Palestinians, the Arabs will leave. They will just leave. They will go where? Egypt, Jordan, wherever. It doesn't matter. They will leave. And that is exactly the narrative that we hear now, the fantasy that 7 million people will pack their bags and vanish. Do you want to, Isa, just say something in closing? Is there anything that we haven't asked you, anything that you'd like to say to our audience?
I want to say that the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians is a relationship between an oppressor and oppressed, occupiers and occupied people. This is the description of the relationship. It's not a conflict between two entities and two armies and anything like that. We are the oppressed without basic rights, and we are stateless, and we have nothing to do to the occupation. And usually occupied people, oppressed people, people living without basic human rights, should not be judged at all. We should judge the occupiers and the oppressors and force them and pressure them to change their policies and end their occupation and apartheid. Something else very important. Without the American blind support to Israel, Israel will not be able to maintain the occupation and the apartheid for that long. The occupation exists because of the American blind support, official blind support, because of a lot of money is coming from many American Jews to the occupation and to the settlement. So I hope from the American Jews to really think about what they are doing and what they contribute to. On the other hand, I'm very proud of many American Jews and many American people and many people all over the world and Jews all over the world who are contributing to make the occupation costly, who are using creative nonviolence ideas to highlight the occupation, to loud our voices as Palestinians, and they work with us as friends, as brothers, and as sisters, and we have a movement and against the occupation, against apartheid, pro-peace, pro-coexistence, pro-living together with full equal rights as Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And without concrete actions against the occupation, without banishing the occupation and apartheid, nothing will change. But the solidarity groups are giving me power, giving me energy, giving the Palestinian hope, giving the Palestinians really energy to continue resisting the occupation and feeling that one day we will be treated as equal human beings as everybody else in the world. And I want to thank you, Ayelet. I always remember the photo together here with the soldiers. I have it until now. To me, I have it in the house, big one, when I was explaining to you Hebron. And I hope from the audience to come and learn more and more from the ground about the situation before they judge.
Anybody listening to this podcast, absolutely anyone, if you come, I will arrange for you to visit Isa in Hebron if he's not arrested. I will arrange for you to see what the reality on the ground. I will bring you here. Just send me an email, ayelet.waldman@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, Isa. This has been really a terrific discussion.
Thank you, Isa. Thank you for being so inspiring and generous with your time. I will see you again.
Bye-bye. See you again.
Boundary Issues is produced and edited by Paul Waldman. Our music is by Zeke Shabon. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at waldmanpodcast@gmail.com. And this is a listener-supported podcast, so if you'd like to support us, you can go to patreon.com/boundaryissues. See you next time.